Hey everyone, and welcome to another bonus episode of your favorite podcast, Never to Be Seen Again. My name is Laura, and I am your host. So, I'm just going to release this secret. Well, not really a secret, but you know I don't tell you until I get to the regular episode. Episode 29 is going to cover disappearances in Connecticut. And when I started going through the cases in Connecticut, I came across the case of Janice Catherine Pocket. People from Connecticut are probably going to know about this case, but I didn't. And when I looked into it, it really led me down a rabbit hole. It led me to actually four other disappearances and to a convicted child molester. So I thought that it would be great to give you this bonus episode and cover five disappearances because not all five of these disappearances are in Connecticut, so it wouldn't have made much sense. I couldn't have told you all five disappearances in the Connecticut episode because some of these are actually in Wyoming, maybe, I believe, but we'll get to it. We'll start out this episode talking about Janice and her disappearance, and we're going to move into the other cases throughout the story, so it's going to be a lot of information. It's probably going to bounce back and forth on the timeline, but I'm going to try and tell you so that you, in a manner in which you can follow it and understand it clearly, and if you can't, I'm sorry. Episode 29... The full episode in Connecticut will be released next week. So if this is just going to be too much for you, just go ahead and skip this bonus episode and move on to Connecticut's episode where it'll be a little more clear cut. So let's get into Janice herself. So unlike the regular episodes, I'm not going to give you the Doe Network case number or the Namus case number. All of these cases that I'm going to tell you about are actually on the Charlie Project, so if you want to know more about each individual case, you can, of course, search it yourself or find the Charlie Project profile, and you'll be able to get all the numbers if you need be. I will give you the investigating agency information, so that way, if you do have any information that might help solve these cases, that you can contact them. So, Janice Catherine Pocket is a Caucasian female with blonde hair and blue eyes. She was born on October 15th of 1965, and she was only 7 at the time of her disappearance. She would be 54 now. She stood at 4 foot tall and only 65 pounds. She was last seen wearing a navy blue shorts with an imprinted American flag and star design, a blue and white striped pullover shirt, white socks, and blue sneakers. Now, at the time of her disappearance, Janice had a gap between her front teeth, well, because she was 7 and, you know, 7-year-olds have gaps between their teeth, so. Janice was actually last seen leaving, and this is so heartbreaking. This is so innocent when I tell you the details of her disappearance. It broke my heart just a little bit more. So Janice was actually last seen leaving her family's home on Anthony Road in Tolan, Connecticut on July 26th of 1973. She had planned to ride her metallic green Murray bicycle, which had a bell and a banana seat, through the neighborhood to search for a butterfly that she had caught and left on a rock a few days earlier. She even brought with her an envelope to put the butterfly in so that she could bring it back home. This was the first time that her parents actually allowed Janice to go out by herself. The thing is, though, that she never came back home, and Janice's mother, after about 30 minutes, goes to find her and doesn't find her, but instead finds her bicycle about half an hour after she was last seen. The bicycle was found on Rhodes Road near a wooded area less than a mile away from her home. The butterfly and the envelope, they were never found. Now, it is believed that Janice actually found that butterfly and put it in that envelope before she was taken or before she disappeared. So Janice was actually one of five people that disappeared from the same general area during a 10-year time period. And this is where we're going to get into another case. All of those five missing people were females. They ranged in age from 7 to 20, and two of them were later found deceased years after they disappeared. The other three still remain missing. So one of those five females that were missing is a girl by the name of Lisa White. Her name is actually Lisa Joy White. So let's talk about her for a minute. Lisa is a Caucasian female with blonde hair and blue eyes. She was born on February 2nd of 1961, and she was 13 at the time of her disappearance. She would be 59 now. She was 5 foot tall and 110 pounds when she disappeared, and she was wearing green pants and a blue denim jacket. I don't know if, did I mention that she had blonde hair and blue eyes? Lisa has a small pockmark on her forehead above her right eye. She was very good physical condition at the time of her disappearance. I'm sorry, just a second. She danced and did acrobatics, so she was very, limber and physically capable. Her teeth were actually perfectly aligned because she once upon a time had braces, so they were set very properly, and she wouldn't have had a gap like Janice would have. So Lisa was actually last seen in Vernon, Connecticut on November 1st of 1974. The night before Lisa disappeared, she had been arrested for underage drinking, and her parents grounded her because of this. After her mom went to work at 4:30 on November 1st, 4:30 p.m., Lisa snuck out to visit a friend that lived on Prospect Street in Rockville, Connecticut, about 2 miles away. Following her visit at her friend's house, she decided to go home, to walk home, and this was at about 7:30 p.m. The issue is that she never came back home. Now, Lisa did leave a note for her mother saying that she was in love with an older boy, and, quote, "You think I'm a little girl, but I'm not," end quote. According to her sister, she associated with older boys and some men. The police initially believed that Lisa had actually run away from home, but currently, or after some time actually, her case moved into suspected homicide. So that's about Lisa's disappearance. Now, I will say that oftentimes when you look up Janice Pockett's case, you will see Lisa White's name associated with it, but there is actually no connection that police were able to find that connects, Lisa and Janice's cases. So they cannot confirm that they are actually related in any way. So let's get back to Janice, because that's all I have on Lisa. Charles Pierce, a man by the name of Charles Pierce, who is now dead, he was a pedophile who was suspected in many, many child disappearance cases in New England through the 1950s and the 1970s. Now, Charles Pierce actually confessed to Janice's murder. He claimed to have buried her in Lawrence, Massachusetts, in an area near an unidentified boy who was another one of his victims. Now, police thought that this unidentified boy was going to be Angelo Puglisi, who was a Massachusetts child who vanished 3 years after Janice disappeared. But when police go to this location to look for Janice and this unidentified boy, they never find them. They never find the graves and they never find any bodies. So let me tell you about Angelo. Angelo is a Caucasian male with brown hair and brown eyes. He was born on February 2nd of 1965, and he was 10 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 54 now. He stood at 4 foot tall, weighed 65 pounds. He was last seen wearing a bathing suit, a towel, and sneakers. Angelo is mildly epileptic. He would need hospital treatment if he had a seizure. Angelo has three scars along his spine and a skin discoloration on his chest. And Angelo also goes by Andy. So Angelo was last seen at the Higgins Memorial Swimming Pool, a public pool, at approximately 100 yards from his family's home near the stadium housing projects on East Dalton Street in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The day he was last seen was actually August 21st of 1976. His mother told investigators that he called home at about 3:30 p.m. that day and spoke to one of his brothers. Angelo gave no indication at that time that anything was wrong. A lifeguard at the pool reported that he saw Angelo walking around the area at approximately 5:45 p.m., and that was actually the last time anyone had seen him. Investigators initially believed that Angelo was a runaway. He was the product of a broken home, and they speculated that he might have felt torn between his parents. Foul play is now suspected in Angelo's disappearance. His parents were both considered suspects in his case and have not officially been removed from the list of possible offenders, but investigators doubt that either one was actually involved in his disappearance. Now, let's talk about why Charles Pierce, they believe that Charles Pierce was talking about Angelo when he was telling them about the unidentified boy in the grave. It's actually because, based on the description that Charles Pierce gave, they figured that it matched Angelo's description. Charles Pierce claimed that he sexually assaulted and buried this quote unquote unidentified boy in a grave, which of course he said was near Janice's. But like I mentioned, neither body or the graves were discovered. Now, Charles Pierce was familiar with the Lawrence area and was a suspect in more than a dozen children's disappearances. Like I said, from the 1950s through the 1970s, all throughout New England. He was convicted of a Massachusetts murder and was serving a 20-year prison term when he died in 1999. Now, there is another suspect in Angelo's case, and his name is Wayne W. Chapman. He is a Providence, or was, I'm not sure if he's still alive. He was a Providence, Rhode Island native who may have been a pedophile associate of Charles Pierce. Chapman was arrested in Waterloo, New York, in September of 1976 while he was driving a converted van that had once been a blue delivery truck. Chapman's vehicle closely resembled the description of a van one of Angelo's friends actually saw near the pool where Angelo was last seen. A witness told the authorities that he and another boy found a large pit in the woods near the pool. The friend stated that the hole could have been large enough to hold a child's body. When he returned to the area just a few days later, the pit had actually been filled in. This spot actually has never been proven to be a grave site, though, and I don't know if they like searched the area and didn't find anything, or if they just didn't bother with it at all. It doesn't really say. So investigators also found child pornography material, a starter pistol, and a sock which appeared to be bloodstained in Chapman's vehicle. The sock was eventually lost, and it was never proven whether the substance on it was actually blood. Chapman was later convicted of the 1975 rape of two boys. He had lured both of those boys from the same swimming pool Angelo had vanished from. So Rhode Island police have a letter stating that Chapman was working in that state at the time of Angelo's disappearance. Chapman has never been charged in connection to Angelo's case, though. He served his prison sentence and was civilly committed as a sexually dangerous offender, but he was released in 2019. He is in his 70s and has Parkinson's disease, and after his release, he was sent to a Boston medical facility, although his sex offender registration lists him as quote unquote homeless. So I didn't really do much research on this Chapman guy. I know he was released in 2019, so last year, but I don't know if he is still alive. There is a book, I'm sorry, a documentary about Angelo's case called Have You Seen Andy? Angelo's childhood friend Melanie Perkins actually produced this documentary. So if you're interested in watching something about it, search for Have You Seen Andy, and I'm sure you can find it. So two excavations near Lawrence in 1999 failed to locate Angelo's remains, and his case is still considered opened and unresolved. The investigating agency in Angelo Gene Puglisi's disappearance is Lawrence Police Department. And I forgot to tell you, the investigating agency for Lisa's case, which is actually Vernon Police Department. So if you have any information on either of those cases, you can contact them and provide them with your information. So let's get back once again to Janice. So Angelo, I'm sorry, Charles Pierce claimed that he murdered Janice, and gave them the location of this grave site, but no, they weren't located. Then nothing really happens for a while, and then in 2000, there's another twist in Janice's case. So in 2000, and this is where we're really going to get into some stuff, there were bone fragments of a child that were discovered in a garage. The garage belonged to a man by the name of Nathaniel Barjona. Nathaniel Barjona is a man that was charged with the 1996 abduction and presumed murder of Zachary Ramsey in Great Falls, Montana. Those charges were actually later dismissed due to lack of evidence, but we're going to talk about Zachary Ramsey for just a minute because I want you to know about his case. So Zachary Xerxes Ramsey is a biracial male with brown hair and brown eyes. He was born on December 18th of 1985. He was only 10 at the time of his disappearance, and he would be 34 now. He too was 4 foot tall, and he was only 100 pounds. He was last seen wearing a blue denim jacket with green sleeves, a blue football jersey with the last name Zachary imprinted on the back in gold letters. He was wearing stonewashed jeans and black high-top sneakers. Zachary has scars between his eyebrows and on one of his arms, although it doesn't say which one. He had blotchy skin at the time of his 1996 disappearance. He has facial dimples. Zachary wears eyeglasses, but he was not carrying them at the time that he disappeared. And of course, Zachary goes by Zach. So, Zach departed from the apartments that he shared with his mom in the 400 block of North 4th Street in Great Falls, Montana, at approximately 7:30 a.m. on February 6th of 1996. He was walking to Witter School that early in the morning. Witnesses saw him walk down the alley near the 400 block of North 5th Street shortly after he left. But he never arrived at school. Zachary had actually ran away once a month prior to his disappearance, but he actually called his mom to come get him within about an hour. He lived with his mom and two siblings at that apartment at the time of his disappearance. A neighbor reported that Nathaniel Barjona was in the area of the alley around the same time Zachary was. Another witness told authorities that he saw Zachary crossing North 6th Street at approximately 7:45 a.m. The witness stated that Zachary appeared to be crying and was being followed by a man who was apparently upset. Investigators believe that the man was Barjona and that he abducted Zachary by using a stun gun to subdue him shortly thereafter. School officials contacted Zach's mom when he failed to report for classes during the day. His mom filed a missing persons report later that afternoon, but Zachary has never been heard from again. Barjona was charged with Zachary's abduction and murder in 2000. Authorities suspected that Barjona, whose given name is actually David P. Brown, preyed on young children, mainly boys. Barjona also confessed to cannibalistic activities. He bragged that he hunted Zachary, among other grisly claims. I'm going to tell you about Barjona after I tell you about all these missing children, because I want you to get an idea of who he is. So, Barjona was convicted of two unrelated counts of child molestation in Montana in February of 2002. He vowed to appeal the decision and maintained his innocence in all charges against him. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed something. Barjona actually had a lengthy criminal history, and he served a prison sentence for the abduction and attempted murder of two Massachusetts boys in 1977. Authorities stated that Zachary's body would not be recovered due to Barjona's suspected cannibalism. Prosecutors actually sought the death penalty for Barjona's crimes. Barjona is also, like I mentioned, a suspect in Janice's disappearance in Connecticut. He was actually a teenager at the time of her disappearance, but at that point in time, he already had a pretty extensive criminal history, so it wouldn't have been uncharacteristic. He also lived near the area at the time that Janice, was last seen trying to locate that butterfly. Barjona was actually investigated as a possible suspect in the disappearance, the 1997 Wyoming disappearance of a girl by the name of Amanda Dawn Galleon. Initially, Amanda was classified as a runaway, but her social security number has never been used. So I'm pretty sure that now they believe that she's a homicide victim. So let's talk about Amanda Galleon for a minute. So Amanda is a Caucasian female. She had blonde hair and blue eyes. I don't know if you're seeing a trend here among the females with the blonde hair and the blue eyes. I just noticed that apparently somebody has a type. Anyway, Amanda's hair was apparently dyed black at the time of her 1997 disappearance. She was born on February 13th of 1983. She was 14 at the time of her disappearance, and she would be 36 now. She stood at 5'2" and weighed only 100 pounds. So Amanda was last seen walking to school during the morning hours of October 13th, 1997, in Gillette, Wyoming. She never arrived at class that day and has not been heard from again. The school didn't notify her parents that she was absent, and it wasn't until 6 p.m. that her family realized that she had never made it to class. Amanda had moved to the area only about 6 weeks prior to her disappearance. At the time, investigators believed that she had run away with her 20-year-old boyfriend, Patrick Gehring. When questioned about Amanda's disappearance, Gehring said he had last seen her at 7:15 a.m. on the day that she disappeared. Police believed that Patrick Gehring was actually hiding her. But on October 19th, Gehring also disappeared. His vehicle was found abandoned on the wrong side of the road, facing the wrong direction, and he has never been seen again. Now, since Gehring's disappearance, his social security number also hasn't been used. So some agencies actually consider foul play in both Patrick Gehring and Amanda Galeon's disappearance. So Wyoming authorities actually reopened Amanda's investigation in 2000 after they were contacted by a Montana investigator. That was the same year that Barjona was arrested for the abduction and presumed murder of Zach Ramsey. So I'll tell you about Patrick Gehring as well. He is a Caucasian male with brown hair and brown eyes. He was born on May 28th of 1977. He was 20 at the time of his disappearance, and he would be 43 now. He stood at 5'5" and weighed 160 pounds. Patrick's right ear is not fully developed. He has a 1-inch scar on his right temple. His hair was in a crew cut at the time of his disappearance. The investigating agency in his case is Campbell County Sheriff's Office. So if you know anything about Patrick Lee Gehring, you can contact them. The investigating agency in Amanda Galeon's disappearance is actually Gillette Police Department. So you can contact them if you have any information on her or her disappearance. So let's get back to Barjona and his connection to these cases. So Barjona, in December of 2001, a handwritten list of names entitled Lake Webster was discovered in Barjona's possession. Now, some news reports stated that Andrew Amato was among the children featured on this list, but apparently this is not true. Andrew Amato's name is not on that list. Andrew disappeared from Webster, Massachusetts in 1978, and there has been actually no ties between Andrew Amato and Barjona. But I'm going to tell you about Andrew John Amato anyway, because his name came up in this case, and he needs to be found as well. So Andrew John Amato is a Caucasian male with blonde hair and blue or hazel eyes. He was born on February 1st of 1974. He was only 4 at the time of his disappearance. He would be 46 now. He stood at 3'6" and weighed only 38 pounds. He was last seen wearing a maroon hooded zip-up snorkel jacket, dungarees, a white Mickey Mouse t-shirt, and brown suede shoes with dark brown stripes on each side of the instep. Andrew's nickname is Andy as well. He has a 1-inch scar on the right side of his head at the front of the hairline and a mole behind his right ear. Andrew resided in a mobile home on Richards Avenue in Webster, Massachusetts. He played in the woods behind nearby Ash Street Trailer Park with his 7-year-old sister and their 6-year-old cousin during the morning hours of September 30th, 1978. Andrew and his cousin went deeper into the woods without his sister. Then Andrew stumbled and hurt himself, dropped and lost his favorite toy, then began crying and running in circles. He refused to leave without the toy, and his cousin told him to stay put, and she walked back to the family home for assistance at about 10:30 a.m., but Andrew disappeared by the time that they had got back to the woods, and he has never been heard from again. an extensive search of the area, which lasted for about 10 days and included the National Guard, produced no clues as to Andrew's whereabouts. He and his sister and cousin had been forbidden to play in the woods and had sneaked there on the day of his disappearance. Andrew disappeared only 50 yards away from Route 52, which is now Interstate 395. Some people theorize that he wandered over to the road and was picked up by a motorist passing through. Webster, Massachusetts is on the Connecticut border and also only a 10 to 15 minute drive from Rhode Island. So it's right there in the middle of three states. Authorities excavated a wooded area off of Mine Brook Road in June of 1998, nearly 20 years after Andrew disappeared. Investigators learned that evidence related to his case may have been buried in the forest, which was approximately 5 miles from the location of Andrew's disappearance. The search, though, failed to produce any material connected to Andrew's case. Officials then discovered that handwritten list of names entitled Lake Webster in Barjona's possession. But as I mentioned, there apparently is some discrepancies on whether Andrew's name was actually on that list. Okay, so you remember that bone fragment that was located in Barjona's garage? Well, DNA testing was conducted on it in 2001, but it was proved that that bone was not part of Zachary's, Janice's, or Amanda's remains. Now, Andrew's DNA was never compared to the bone, so it's actually unknown if that bone could have been Andrew's, or if Andrew is actually connected to Barjona. Barjona was never charged in connection with any of the other disappearances, and he actually ended up dying of a blood clot in a Montana prison in April of 2008 at the age of 51, and a lot of questions remain unanswered after that. So, with none of the cases that I have told you about in this bonus episode have been resolved. In Janice's case, the Connecticut State Police is the point of contact in her investigation. So if you have any information about Janice's disappearance, you can contact them and provide them with that. But we have a lot of missing people, a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of connections that aren't really connections, and it seems like there is one person that seems to connect the majority of these missing cases, and that is Nathaniel Barjona. So let me tell you about him. Some of this information I've already mentioned in the cases, but I want to give you an idea of who he is and the kind of monster that he was in life. So in late July of 1964, 7-year-old Barjona lured a 5-year-old neighbor into his basement, telling her that he had received a Ouija board for his birthday that could predict the future. Once this child was in his basement, Barjona attempted to strangle the girl, but her screams attracted the attention of his mother, who came to her rescue. In January of 1970, at the age of 12, Barjona managed to lure another neighbor, a 6-year-old boy, to a nearby hill, claiming he wanted to go sledding with him. Once they arrived, however, Barjona sexually assaulted this boy. A few years later, Barjona attempted to lure two boys riding their bicycles down his street to a nearby cemetery where he intended to murder them, but one of the boys grew suspicious and persuaded his friend not to go. Oh, those boys were smart. In late March of 1975, Barjona impersonated a police officer, abducted an 8-year-old Richard O'Connor while he was on his way to school, then proceeded to sexually assault and strangle him. A neighbor looking out of her window observed the abduction and notified authorities, who began searching for the boy. A patrol car later observed a car matching that used in the abduction parked far away from the others in a parking lot, and after calling for backup, ordered Barjona out of the car. O'Connor was found in the car, bloodied, having defecated and urinated on himself from the sexual assault, and near the point of death. A few days before his high school graduation, Barjona drove to nearby Hartford, Connecticut, and again impersonated a police officer, abducted a nine-year-old girl, whom he savagely assaulted in his car. After the child began vomiting and convulsing from the assault, he drove up to a sidewalk and threw the girl out of the car. A nearby witness saw the incident and got Barjona's license plate, leading to his arrest. The assault never got back to Barjona's probation officer, and he was released from parole in May of 1976 for his earlier abduction and sexual assault of O'Connor. When Barjona's probationary period was over, he received a letter thanking him for his cooperation. On September 24th of 1977, Barjona claimed to be an undercover FBI agent, convinced two boys coming out of the White City Cinemas in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, to enter his vehicle. Barjona then transported the boys to a secluded area where he handcuffed, then proceeded to strangle and flick cigarette ashes on them. After jumping repeatedly on the chest of one of the boys, the 375-pound Barjona believed that he had killed him, then drove off with the other still alive in the trunk. However, the first boy regained consciousness and managed to find help, leading shortly thereafter to Barjona's arrest. The other boy was found still alive in Barjona's trunk. For this crime, Barjona was convicted of attempted murder and received the maximum sentence of 18 to 20 years in prison. While in prison, he was transferred to Bridgewater State Hospital. On March 22nd of 1984, he changed his name to Nathaniel Benjamin Levi Barjona. He gave several reasons for changing his name. He told friends and relatives that he wanted to know what it was like to be discriminated against and persecuted as a Jew. During a later interview with Dr. Michael Stone for the television show Most Evil, he claimed he was Jewish and wanted his name to reflect that. Later in the same year, Superior Court Judge Walter E. Steele ruled that Massachusetts had failed to prove that Barjona was dangerous, and he was released before moving to Great Falls, Montana. During this time, Barjona confided in his psychiatrist that he fantasized about abducting, murdering, and cannibalizing children. On August 9th of 1991, just a month after being released from the Bridgewater State Hospital, Barjona observed a 7-year-old boy sitting alone in a car outside of a post office in Oxford, Massachusetts. Barjona, who weighed 275 pounds at the time, entered the vehicle and sat on the boy, thrusting his mass atop the boy's fragile chest. Some witnesses, along with the boy's mother, observed the event and ran to this boy's rescue, causing Barjona to flee. An officer recognized Barjona's description from over 15 years earlier, and he was later arrested for this attack. At first, Barjona claimed that he entered the car to get out of the rain, but later admitted that he intended to kill this boy. For the attack of this little boy, Barjona was sentenced to probation in Montana. So then they have the disappearance. Then we go through the disappearance of Zach Ramsey. And I'm just going to go through Zach Ramsey's case or disappearance quickly again, because there are more details about it. So on February 6th of 1996, 10-year-old Zach left his apartment at about 7:34 a.m. to go to school. He was taking his usual route through the alleyways in the 400 block of 4th Street. Ramsey was, I gave you his clothing description earlier, but he was wearing a blue denim jacket with green sleeves, a football jersey with his last name imprinted on the back in gold letters, stonewashed jeans, and black high-top sneakers. Now, a family of three who lived in an apartment in the alleyway reported seeing Ramsey there that morning, and I mentioned that to you earlier. They also, of course, reported seeing an off-white four-door car nearly run over him. Another witness reported seeing Ramsey standing in the alleyway and that he appeared to be waiting for someone. Yet another witness who lived near the end of the alleyway reported seeing Ramsey distressed with an obese adult male following him a few feet behind him at about 7:45 a.m. A witness reported seeing Barjona standing beside a dumpster in the alleyway at 7:15 a.m. while taking out the trash. He was wearing a navy blue police-like jacket. The same witness also reported seeing Ramsey enter the alleyway later and that Barjona was still standing beside the dumpster. Somewhere between where the alley cuts into 6th Street and comes out on 7th, Ramsey disappeared. He has, of course, never been seen or heard from again. And despite the objection of Ramsey's mom, a judge declared him legally dead in 2011. Police investigators conducted years, I'm sorry, police investigations conducted years after Ramsey went missing determined that Barjona had access to his mom's off-white, four-door, 1978 Toyota Corolla on the day that Zach Ramsey disappeared, and that his mother and brother were out of town for a funeral. It was moreover determined that Barjona did not work on February 6th of 1996, nor the day immediately proceeding days the, nor on the days immediately preceding that day. While searching Barjona's apartment, detectives found a list of boys' names, which included previous victims and Zachary Ramsey, followed by the words "died." Furthermore, which apparently they didn't have that on anywhere else, but apparently that list that Andrew's name was on apparently had Zach Ramsey's name on, and it had "died" right beside it. So, furthermore, dozens of newspaper clippings were found in Barjona's apartment following Ramsey's case. A former roommate of Barjona described finding clothes in his apartment which appeared to match those Ramsey was last seen wearing on the day of his disappearance, in addition to bloody gloves. Another roommate and others claimed that Barjona sometimes spontaneously brought up Zachary in conversation. Investigators also found notebooks with seemingly arbitrary characters which were believed to be coded writings. With the help of FBI and after months of effort, the writing was decoded. In the notebook, Barjona described torturing and eating children. There were also macabre recipes involving children's body parts. When detectives sprayed Barjona's garage with luminol, basically, while investigating there, when they were spraying the garage, I'm sorry, with the luminol, the investigator, they were doing this as they were investigating Zach Ramsey's disappearance. But when they sprayed it with luminol, they found the word tita, T-I-T-A, had appeared, which led authorities to believe that Barjona may have been responsible for the abduction of James Teta, a Massachusetts boy who was kidnapped on August 23rd of 1973. Teta's body was discovered on August 25th of 1973 in Ridge, New Hampshire, off of Route 119, and an autopsy revealed that he had been raped and strangled. So Barjona was arrested again in 1999, initially for impersonating a police officer. After searching his home and finding, among other things, many pictures of young children cut out of magazines, and that bone that was, of course, never identified as to who it belonged to, Montana police charged Barjona with kidnapping and sexual assault, as well as the kidnapping and sexual assault of three other boys. Barjona was prosecuted for the abduction and molestation of three boys and convicted of kidnapping, aggravated assault, and sexual assault, including charges that had been that he had tortured one of the boys and hung him from the ceiling. During Barjona's trial, 36-year-old Mary Patrone recognized him as the man who had abducted and assaulted her by dressing as a police officer in 1974. However, the statute of limitations had expired and Barjona could not be charged with that crime. Investigators also suspected Barjona in the disappearance of course, Janice from 10 months earlier. Earlier than Mary Patrone's case. He, of course, Barjona maintained his innocence until his death. Montana authorities were unaware of Barjona's criminal record in Massachusetts, a fact that was cited by activists campaigning to force former sex offenders to register. In December of 2004, the Montana Supreme Court turned down Barjona's appeal and upheld the conviction and the 130-year prison sentence. So Barjona was found unresponsive in his prison cell on the morning of April 13th of 2008. He had been in poor health, and his postmortem postmortem autopsy found significant levels of LDL in the arteries and myocardial infractions, which was, of course, determined to be his cause of death. Now let's talk about these allegations of cannibalism and where they came from and why it's even a thing. So Barjona's earliest interest in the taste of human flesh could actually be traced back to his childhood. Beginning at about the age of six, he would pick at his scabs until his skin was festering, then proceeded to suck on the blood from his wounds. His teachers would call his mother numerous times to notify her that her son's habits were upsetting to the teachers and the students. When he was incarcerated in Montana State Prison, many of the guards actually observed him performing this same habit. One guard reported that once Barjona had the scab in his mouth, that he would appear to be having sex. Ugh. While incarcerated at Bridgewater State Hospital, Barjona confided in his psychiatrist about his murderous and cannibalistic ideations. One of his therapists noted that Brown's sexual fantasies, bizarre in nature, outline methods of torture and intend to dissection and cannibalism, and again express a curiosity about the taste of human flesh. Now, I've been calling him Barjona throughout this whole thing, but keep in mind that he's not born Nathan Barjona. He was actually born David Paul Brown. And sometimes when you look him up or any of the things he said before the name change, you actually have to look for David Paul Brown. So just keep that in mind. If I mention, you know, David Paul Brown, it's the same person as Barjona. It's just however the accounts are recorded under what name. So anyway, although Barjona was known to be a voracious eater, he, who weighed in excess of 300 pounds at some points, financial records indicated that he had not made any significant grocery store purchases for nearly a month after Ramsey disappeared. However, he could have also paid for any groceries using cash or would have been well-stocked in food and meat, so you can't necessarily say he ate Zachary Ramsey. After Zachary Ramsey's disappearance, Barjona also began to hold cookouts in which he was reported to serve burgers, spaghetti, chili, meat pies, casseroles, and the like to his guests. At many of these cookouts, a number of persons told Barjona that the meat had a peculiar taste to it. Barjona's response was that he had gone deer hunting and used deer meat in his dishes. However, Bar Jonah did not own a rifle or a hunting license, nor had he been deer hunting at any time. To one woman who told Bar Jonah that she found the taste of his meat to be repulsive, he replied that he had personally hunted, killed, butchered, and wrapped the meat of the deer. He would later be accused of molesting this woman's son. In Bar Jonah's apartment, detectives also found a number of recipes using children's body parts, which with contemptuous titles such as Little Boy Pot Pie, French Fried Kid, and phrases such as lunch is served on the patio with roasted child. In the decoded journals, Bar Jonah also referred to reference serving these recipes to his neighbors, probably in those cookouts. Also, hair was found inside a meat grinder in his apartment. When the hair was tested for DNA, it was found to belong to an African American male, but did not belong to Zachary Ramsey. The DNA of the hair was also different from the child's bone fragment that was found in his garage, which also did not belong to Zachary Ramsey. So that is Nathaniel Bar Jonah, or David Paul Brown, as he is actually called. And that is quite the tale that started with my research into the disappearance of Janice Catherine Pocket. And here we are, almost an hour later, and it took me that long to tell you about all these disappearances. So I'm going to go over all of the disappearances we talked about and their investigating agencies, so that way, hopefully, it clears a little bit up for you. So the case that started all of this off is, of course, Janice Catherine Pocket, who disappeared from Tolan, Connecticut on July 26th of 1973. The Connecticut State Police is the investigating agency in her case. Then we moved on to Lisa Joy White, who disappeared from Vernon, Connecticut on November 1st of 1974. The Vernon Police Department is the investigating agency in her case. Then we talked about Angelo Jean Puglisi, who disappeared from Lawrence, Massachusetts on August 21st of 1976. The Lawrence Police Department is the investigating agency in his case. Then we really delved into Zachary Xerxes Ramsey's case. He disappeared from Great Falls, Montana on February 6th of 1996. The Great Falls Police Department is the investigating agency in his case. Then we moved on to Amanda Dawn Galleon, which I might have mispronounced her name earlier, and I'm sorry if I did. But she disappeared from Gillette, Wyoming on October 13th of 1997, and the Gillette Police Department is the investigating agency in her case. Then we briefly spoke about her possible boyfriend and potential suspect, Patrick Lee Gehring, who disappeared also from Gillette, Wyoming on October 19th of 1997, which was only 6 days after Amanda disappeared. In his case, the Campbell County Sheriff's Office is the investigating agency. Then the last case we spoke about was Andrew John Amato, who disappeared from Webster, Massachusetts on September 30th of 1978. And the Webster Police Department is the point of contact in his case. As usual, I will post the pictures of all of the missing people that we talked about this week on the Facebook page. I'll also probably add where they are missing from and their last date of contact, just so it clears things up a little bit for you. So that pretty much concludes this bonus episode for you guys. I'm so glad that you tuned in, and I hope that you enjoyed it, and I hope that it wasn't all too confusing for you. As always, I encourage you to do your own research if you are a little bit confused. And like I mentioned, if this case is just this bonus episode is just too much for you, just tune in for regular episode 29 in Connecticut. That'll probably be a little more clear cut and more understandable as far as when the cases occurred, who they are, how they're not connected, because I don't think any of the cases I'm going to be covering in that episode are actually connected, but I do not immediately recall. And I know I told you at the beginning of the episode that I was going to tell you about five missing people, but it ended up being seven. I don't want to make it sound like I forgot about two people, but they just kind of popped into the story and I needed to tell you about them. So it's actually seven missing people, but I'm going to put them all up on the Facebook page. If you're not already following that, I urge you to go locate the Never To Be Seen Again podcast Facebook page. It's at /NTBSA podcast. Go like it and follow it so you can get all the updates on new episodes and, of course, the pictures. Especially in this case, if it will help you be less confused. So, thank you guys, as always, for tuning in to listen. And I can't wait till you come back for episode 29 in Connecticut, where you will hear about those never to be seen again.